This is Ryan Rudecki, and this is the Emergency Medicine Literature of Note Audio Digest podcast covering the month of December 2016. This is just a review of the posts I've made on a few articles of interest for the month of December, and it's coming to you a little bit late because, well, I had a baby, and babies are known for monopolizing your time and energy and sleep. Anyway, so getting into the articles, which of which there are half as many because my December was essentially half as long. The first article I'm going to talk about is Prospective Open Label Safety Study of Intravenous Recombinant Tissue Plasminogen Activator in Wake Up Stroke. And this is published in the Annals of Neurology. And this is one of those articles that people have been circulating about wake-up strokes and how we should possibly be treating wake-up stroke because even though their quote-unquote last seen normal was the night before, there is suspicion that the underlying physiology and hormonal changes and your day-night cycle means that the strokes that have occurred most likely occurred in the couple hours before waking. So they think that these patients are mostly or predominantly in the window, the quote-unquote window for TPA, and should not necessarily be excluded. This is a garbage study. It's an open-label study of 3 years of enrollment with nothing conclusive you can say about it. 40 patients across 5 centers that had these wake-up strokes that they enrolled in this study who were treated with TPA, and they say it's safe, you know, because only 6 of them had ICH, only 2 developed angioedema, and only 1 had systemic hemorrhage. So, you know, in theory, if the TPA was going to benefit them, that might be one thing to talk about. But, you know, the vast majority had NIS less than 10, 4 of which were mimics. So even of these 40 patients that they enrolled over 3 years from these 5 centers, they weren't even all strokes. A lot of them had adverse reactions, and there's no way to say that these somehow did better than a control group. The authors say, let's go do an open label, let's go do a prospective study, and you know there's already one underway, so we should have those results in a couple years, but in the meantime, I'm sure that our enterprising neurologists will continue to try and treat wake-up strokes. This next article I'm going to talk about is Shared Decision-Making in Patients with Low-Risk Chest Pain, a Prospective Randomized Pragmatic Trial, and this is published in the BMJ. And this is a bit of an odd trial. Ostensibly, this is a trial about the evaluation and disposition of low-risk chest pain presenting to the emergency department. The authors frame their discussion section by describing their combination of objective risk stratification and shared decision-making in terms of reducing admission for observation and testing at the index visit. And it's a great success by that measure. Instead of 52% of patients being admitted for observation, they reduced this to 37%. And therefore, resource utilization is reduced, and it's a success. But that's really not what the trial is about. Technically, it's a trial about patient comprehension. The primary outcome is actually the number of questions correctly answered by patients on an immediate post-visit survey. And in theory, in their power calculations, they say, we estimate that 884 patients is going to provide 99% power to detect a 16% difference in patient knowledge between decision aid and usual care arms, which is a very, very strange choice of power and a very unusual, like, what is 16%? What's the difference between, what's the 16% difference clinically meaningful? Well, it's an 8-question survey, so it's essentially one extra question being answered correctly. And they do find a improvement in post-visit comprehension, 3.6 versus 4.2 questions answered correctly. And after clinicians spend a little extra time with each patient, it takes about 1.3 extra minutes with each patient to go over this decision aid, it's not really surprising that they have some sort of increased health literacy. This is all fine and good, and I think it's a beautiful decision instrument. But I don't really understand this mix of shared decision-making with reducing resource utilization. Shared decision-making, to me, is when you allow patients to participate in their treatment when there's some substantial individual variation between the perceived value of different risks, benefits, and alternatives, both on the patient side and on the clinician side. But, you know, I think we all really believe that these low-risk patients should be going home. And the evidence, the vast preponderance of the evidence that almost all of these patients do well. And specifically, in the context of, you know, Mike Weinstock's big retrospective study of patients admitted for chest pain, almost every low-risk patient with chest pain who's admitted to the hospital does not have an adverse event. In Vancouver, British Columbia, they sent home all these patients to get their stress tests as outpatients, and even the ones who had positive stress tests as an outpatient, they did fine in the meantime. So offering a patient admission is really almost a false choice when you're trying to talk them out of it. So the shared decision making here isn't about like sharing a choice of, you know, and weighing the risks and benefits and, you know, different value systems. It's almost about just trying to convince the patient to choose what you really want them to choose. It just seems like a misleading approach to the problem. If we really want to have a shared decision making approach, we should be using this decision aid to help reinforce our recommendation that they do go home, and we shouldn't even be offering them admission in the first place. So, a beautiful trial, lots of hard work, great people doing the trial. I just don't like the mix of, you know, we're just trying to convince them to choose what we would have chosen for them anyway, not really offering them information for two equally valued outcomes, especially the way they discuss, you know, how proud they are of reducing their admission rate in the end. The next article I'm going to talk about is Alpha Blockers for Treatment of Ureteric Stones, Systematic Review and Meta-Analysis. And this is from the BMJ as well. And we've been talking about ureteral stones a whole lot over the past year because we had a couple nice studies, one in The Lancet, one in the Annals of Emergency Medicine, that showed that, you know, what we'd been traditionally sort of been taught to do, to give alpha blockers for ureteral stones, it doesn't really provide the reliable benefit that we'd sort of gone along with believing. The trial in The Lancet comparing a calcium channel blocker to the alpha blocker to placebo, there was really no difference in stone passage rates. If you look through the secondary outcomes, you might say that some large distal stones had a greater passage rate, but for the vast majority of stones, there was no advantage. And when you look at the Annals of Emergency Medicine article, that was about the same sort of thing. What this meta-analysis does is it takes those two really well-designed randomized trials with a lower risk of bias and just plugs in the big pile of crap we had before that. You know, the crap that was in a Cochrane review. These are all like 20 and 40 patient studies with all sorts of risk of bias, with all sorts of conflict of interest from all sorts of places all over the world. Single center, tiny studies from Turkey and Iran and Korea, you know, and some places in the United States. And it's just a whole mishmash of junk. And really what you do when you do a meta-analysis like this is you just pool a bunch of low-quality evidence with high-quality evidence, and that doesn't make your overall result better. So the authors in this meta-analysis say that alpha blockers do have some benefit, but that's just because they've pooled all the crappy evidence from before with our good-quality evidence from recently. You should do a meta-analysis that cleans out some of the junk and only takes the high-quality work. And if you look at only the high-quality work, you'll find that there's a very limited potential benefit for alpha blockers. And my personal practice is just to try and give them when I find patients who have really large stones, you know, 4, 5, 6 millimeters or above, especially if they're having a whole lot of pain, if there's a whole lot of hydro, the patients you look like they're at higher risk for some sort of urologic intervention down the road. And the next article I'm going to look at is called Diagnostic Accuracy of Central Venous Catheter Confirmation by Bedside Ultrasound versus Chest Radiography in Critically Ill Patients, a Systematic Review and Meta-Analysis. And this one comes from the Journal of Critical Care Medicine. And this is a nice little article that pools together a bunch of small studies describing whether you can just use the ultrasound you use to place a central line to just go ahead and confirm its placement without waiting for the chest x-ray. Because I think we've all sort of had that moment where we're waiting for x-ray to come, we're waiting for the x-ray to be shot, we're waiting for the x-ray to be, you know, uploaded, you're waiting to review it or for a radiologist offsite to review it before going ahead and using a central line, which you placed because it was important. And what they've found here, basically, is that ultrasound is good for part of it. Ultrasound's really good at detecting the pneumothorax that you made. It's better than chest x-ray. We kind of already knew that. The pneumothoraces you're picking up are generally clinically insignificant. But when you're on positive pressure ventilation, they're good to know about for sure, even if they are so tiny you can't pick them up on a chest x-ray. then as far as the correct placement or not, if you see it in the wrong place, if you see the, you know, the catheter tip going down the subclavian or up into the carotid by doing your focused ultrasound, then obviously you know you're in the wrong spot. If you don't see where it ends up, it's not necessarily in the wrong spot, not really necessarily in the right spot. And so that's where the limitation of ultrasound comes in. It's just a technically difficult study sometimes to, you know, see the right atrium, to see the superior vena cava. And that's where chest x-ray kind of comes in. So you could probably use these two together to at least make a provisional diagnosis if you really need to use the central line before waiting for a chest x-ray. But I think you kind of, the best practice is probably to combine the information you get from both. I wouldn't just go straight to using ultrasound only to confirm your own central line placement, unless you're really, really good and really, really confident and you have a lot of extenuating circumstances that prevent you from getting a chest x-ray in a really timely fashion. And then the next article I'm going to talk about is called Utility of Chest Radiography in Emergency Department Patients Presenting with Syncope. And this was in WestJEM, and the reason I talk about this is because there were just so many sort of like headlines. Whenever it comes into like this ASEP daily news briefing, you know it's going to be seen by a lot of physicians. And I'm just like, oh, what are they talking about? Patients presenting to the emergency department with complaints of syncope should still undergo routine chest x-rays, research suggests. That's not what it says at all. So there were 575 patients who had syncope, and they were all included in this Boston syncope criteria study from 2003 to 2006. Not everybody got a chest x-ray. Almost everybody who got a chest x-ray had a normal chest x-ray. And there were, 18 people who had positive findings on chest x-ray, 15 of those who went on to have an adverse event. And so I guess they're saying that because there are so many people who had adverse events after they had a positive chest x-ray that you have to go ahead and get a chest x-ray, but that's not the case at all. People who had positive chest x-rays, they had things that were clinically obvious. They were potentially related to their syncope. They were pleural effusions. They were pneumothoraces. They were pneumonias. You know, these were not mysterious diagnoses that could not be picked up if you didn't do the chest x-ray. People who looked like they needed a chest x-ray as part of their appropriate clinical evaluation for syncope got chest x-rays appropriately. I'm sure a lot of these negative ones were done as part of quote-unquote routine, and they probably didn't need to be done. What this study should have told you is that chest x-ray is a very low-value test in syncope and does not need to be routinely performed, but that's not the headline that they gave it when they sort of advertised it on MedPage Today. So the last article this month, like I said, it's a short month because I've been otherwise indisposed, is incidence of coronary intervention in cardiac arrest survivors with non-shockable initial rhythms and no evidence of ST elevation MI. And this is published in the Journal of Resuscitation. Now, when you have a cardiac arrest survivor with return of spontaneous circulation and they have a STEMI on their EKG, it's pretty clear that those patients need to go to the cath lab because they're having a STEMI, and that was probably why they died. Then if you take patients with shockable rhythms, which is essentially VTAC or VFib, you know, there's a little bit more debate there. But, you know, still a ventricular fibrillation arrest is most likely to be cardiac in origin, and you worry about myocardial infarction even if you don't see STEMI. And a lot of those patients, again, you see a culprit lesion, you have an intervention, and the retrospective work from in this field shows that these patients generally do better when you take them to the cath lab, even though it's really hard to say exactly how much better they're doing because there's so many confounders. And unfortunately, this is just sort of more of that same sort of confounded data. What's kind of interesting here is that the author's hypothesis in this, you know, big registry study is that the incidence of coronary intervention would be uncommon, less than 5%, which if it truly is their hypothesis, it's contraindicated by most of their citations, including a meta-analysis citing an overall incidence of CAD in post-arrest patients ranging from 60 to 70%. So if you have 60 or 70% of patients with coronary artery disease and you're putting them in a cath lab after they've had a cardiac arrest, and you think that people aren't going to get intervened on less than 5% of the time, I don't think that's really a valid hypothesis. Regardless, this is a big registry study. There's 1,300 patients, and after all the various exclusions, they get down to 97 patients in their cohort of interest. These are the non-STEMIs who didn't have a shockable rhythm. Why would you take this patient to the cath lab unless you're going to find something? Well, in this cohort of interest, 24 of them underwent intervention. And therefore, the authors say this is an unexpectedly high incidence of coronary intervention, this non-shockable rhythm, and we should continue to rethink whether we should take these patients to the cath lab or not. but they do at least appropriately note that we should not specifically have practice change without further prospective study. After all, in a patient cohort like this, when you're undergoing catheterization after a cardiac arrest, you know, the patients who are going to do well are the ones that they think are going to have some sort of lesion that needs to be treated. So otherwise, you wouldn't select them for the cath lab in the first place. And there's measured and unmeasured confounders influencing the decision to take patients for potential intervention. And then, you know, in this older population, characteristic of a cardiac arrest cohort, some coronary disease, or maybe up to 60 or 70%, is likely to be seen. And in the clinical context of being in the cath lab with a post-arrest patient and you see a potentially culprit lesion, you're going to get some sort of intervention. So despite the surprise these authors report, they likely overestimate any evidence for benefit in this post-arrest population, and better characterization of specific high-yield circumstances is needed. So I think this is the third of these little episodes I've done. I hope you're all enjoying them. Send me some tweets, send me some feedback, and I'll do what I can to improve. Until then, you can catch me on the Annals of Emergency Medicine podcast with Rory Spiegel. You can find my work in ASEP Now, and I promise there will be more articles next. Take care.